Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's time. Steel Empowerment Network. 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment. It's your man Marvin Rome, coming to you for another episode of Community Conversations with Brother George. Part 11, 1-1 in Mississippi. Oh yeah. There's no better love than love for self and kind. Oh yeah. All right. There is no better love than love for self and kind. And we're working on ourselves 365 days of the year of improving ourselves. And that is what the NAAEA is all about. It's about developing programs and concepts to get us to think about where we are and where we're going. So the NAAEA is about ensuring that the needs of the African-American communities are met through the development of programs and services that listen, educate, inspire, motivate, and empower the African-American community to excel in every area. We're not playing with this thing no more. We're talking about politics, economics, athletics, which encompasses health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, culture, and education. When you got a serious cultural program going on that educate our people on who they are and what we should be doing as men and women and how we can better work together, you can't beat that. Teaching us how to love on each other, respect and appreciate each other for who we are, and meeting each other right where we are. All right, let's go on over to Brother George. Brother George, are you with us today?
Yes, sir, I am, brother. And I'm glad that I'm here. You know, glad to be able to share, you know, some information with the people. And, you know, let's go after it, brother.
All right. Welcome again. And this series has really been a powerful series. I want to, again, challenge you to go back and listen to 1 through 10. Really, really good stuff. 10 is beautiful. You got to go and listen to that. Okay, let's start, as always, with our Willie Lynch moment and the impact of Willie Lynch.
Yes, sir, brother. Once again, I'm going to read from a book by Naeem Akbar called Changing Images of Psychological Slavery, and it is very relevant to the Willie Lynch syndrome that we had. Another serious handicap which we inherited from slavery is the African-American clown. One of the primary forms of remaining in favor with the slave master by the slave was to provide entertainment for the master and his household. It is easy to observe that men exult in his superiority over lower animals by teaching them to do tricks and being entertained by those tricks. In much the same way, the slave owner prided himself in his superiority by being entertained by the slave. Writers have long pointed to the gesture, the clown, or the fool as an inferior one who was responsible for making his superior laugh. A person for your clown has always been one of the major ways to assert your domination over a person. Mockery is one of the most sophisticated forms of humiliation. And today, that's what they mean by, you know, we laugh when it ain't funny and we scratch when it don't itch and all these different kinds of things that we still do when we get around white folks and we start talking soft when we get around them. We'll lower our voices and all that because we're acknowledging that they're around and we're still trying to do things to make them feel comfortable. And that's a part of what happened with the purpose of Willie Lynch. Always trust the slave master and never trust another brother or sister. So that's the Willie Lynch segment for today.
Thank you, brother. Are we handicapped? In certain ways, we are at level. But let's stop that clowning and let's get serious about the business of developing our community and ourselves. Let's become proud of who we are, and let's continue to work to develop ourselves. Brother George, take us into the funk era. All right.
Well, brother, when you talk about the 1970s, you can't really talk about the 70s without talking about the funk era. The funk era, you know, was started out with James Brown back in, really, actually in the 1960s. And then, you know, the famous Parliament Funkadelics, the Ohio Players, Kool and the Gang. In the immortal words of George Clinton and the band Parliament, we need the funk. Gotta have that funk. Oh, yeah, it's time to get funky. Funk music is a popular genre of the 1970s and 1980s, technically defined by a combination of African-American soul music and a strong beat. But the definition offered by musical legend Prince is closer to home. If you can describe it, it ain't funky. Funk is defined less by a strict set of stylistic rules and more by an attitude, with of course a beat that encourages dancing. But if you want to really understand it, you need to know the history. Gotta have that funk. A funky sound. Of the 1960s soul artists, one stood out for an essentially distinct sound. James Brown had a strong voice, but also focused his music much more heavily on a bold rhythm. While rhythm had long been a staple of African-American genre, Brown's use was different. It was sharp, disproportionately heavy, and existentially by the lyrics and Brown's performance style. This rhythm, which demanded being danced to, along with Brown's unapologetic attitude and racial pride, would go on to be the cornerstone of funk music. So essentially, James Brown, the Parliament Funkadelics, the Ohio Players with Fire, and Kool and the Gang with Celebration. A lot of those were the sounds of the 1970s and 80s.
My brother, say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. If you ain't proud of yourself, guess what? Tune into the NAAEA and Empowerment Saturday and all the other stuff that we're doing, and I'm sure you'll find some pride in yourself. Brother, let's go down to the political poets and a short lesson on political theory and its systems. Give it to us, brother. Ow.
Well, I wanted to talk about the poets because the poets also, the political poets, were also in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But before I talk about that, I wanted to lay some groundwork because a lot of these poets were attached to different political systems that they believed in. Now, the first one that I'm going to talk about is not a system. What it is a philosophy. And some people get that confused. They think it's a system like capitalism, but it's not. And the first one is Marxism. Marxism is a social, political, and economic philosophy named after Karl Marx, which examines the effect of capitalism on labor, productivity, and economic development, and argues for a worker revolution to overturn capitalism in favor of communism or socialism or some other system, which it depends on which system you want. Marxists posit that the struggle between social classes, specifically between the bourgeoisie or the capitalist and the proletariat or the workers defines economic relations in a capitalist economy and will inevitably lead to the revolutionary communists. Now, that's some of the things that some of these people with Black Lives Matter are also talking about also. Now, I also would like to give you a definition for communism. Now, we heard that Marxism was like basically the belief that as capitalism, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and the gap gets wider, that it's going to cause, you know, people at the bottom to start revolting because the capitalists are going to start taking away your health care, start taking away your benefits at work, and so you're going to end up just working for a regular, you know, for a regular paycheck, and you're not getting nothing, you know, to actually protect your family. Now, communism is a political and economic ideology that positions itself in opposition to liberal democracy and capitalism, advocating instead for a classless system in which the means of production are owned communally and private property is non-existent or severely curtailed. Now, what I'm doing is I'm simply giving you definitions. Which of these particular systems that you might like, you know, that's up to you. But I'm just giving you definitions so that you'll understand what they're talking about. Now, socialism is a populist economic and political system based on public ownership, also known as collective or common ownership of the means of production. This means include the machinery, tools, factories used for production for produce goods that aim to directly satisfy human needs. Communism and socialism are umbrella terms referring to two left-wing schools of economic thought. Both oppose capitalism, but socialism predates the Communist Manifesto in 1884. Now, last but not least is the capitalist system. Capitalism is an economic system in which private individuals or businesses own capital goods. The production of goods or services is based on supply and demand in the general market, known as a market economy, rather than through central planning, known as a planned economy or a command economy. Now, the United States has a capitalist system, but the United States' capitalist system is not pure capitalism because they have some governmental restraints that are attached to the capitalist system that we have here in the United States. And so what that is that was a brief overview of what those mean. So if you didn't catch all of the definitions, you always can go back and re-listen to what I spoke about and get those definitions straight.
You are listening to NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George. We're talking about the Black Scholarship and the Funk Era. And I'd like to mention really quickly in terms of capitalism, that's the system that we're functioning in, and you can choose which one you like or which one you want, but let's master the capitalistic system by understanding the importance of economics and how to manage this capital that comes into our pockets that we make people rich with. So you got to learn how to manage your money. It's a part of the economic system and an economic platform for the NAAEA. It's about teaching our families and our children how to manage their money. Now, Empowerment Saturday show coming up. You don't want to miss it. Join us each Saturday at 2 p.m. for Empowerment Saturday. Scary conversations. What our people by our people for our people. And now let's move on to Brother Leroy Jones.
Now, Leroy Jones was a he was a serious poet. And what he did was he eventually changed his name to Amiria Baraka. I hope I pronounced that right, because I have trouble sometimes pronouncing his name. But Baraka, following the assassination of Malcolm X in 1965, Jones renounced his bohemian lifestyle and divorced his wife, Haiti. He moved uptown to Harlem and helped usher in the Black Arts Movement by founding the Black Arts Theater School called BARTS. Oh, that's the acronym, I'm sorry. And which produced plays for Black audiences. After the school closed in 1967, he returned to Newark and married an African-American poet named Sylvia Robinson, who eventually changed her name to Amina Baraka. The couple founded the Spirit House Players, which produced Baraka's anti-police brutality plays. So he was into anti-police brutality as well as you see those today. During the late 1960s, Jones converted to Islam and changed his name to Amiria Baraka. He also embraced Black nationalist themes and organizations such as the US in Los Angeles, California. He later served as Secretary General in the National Black Political Assembly and Chairman of the Congress of African People, a Pan-Africanist organization. In 1972, Baraka became the lead organizer of the National Black Political Convention held in Gary, Indiana. By the mid-1970s, Baraka underwent another philosophical change and became a Marxist, supporting the overthrow of capitalism. And that's what I was talking about some of the brothers, you know, there's poets and some of the brothers that I spoke about last week, you know, that were nationalists and Pan-Africanists and revolutionaries. That's what they did. They started out, you know, riding with the Freedom Riders, and then philosophies began to change because they felt as though that they could not accomplish what they wanted to accomplish by the integrationalist approach.
Switch your philosophy from self to community by focusing on education. And this is what we're doing with the NAAEA. One of the pillars and components of the NAAEA is education. We have to educate our people. We have to learn about our people. And today we're learning more about who we are, some of our greats. And today we'll move right into Brother Gil Scott Heron.
Now, I know that just about everybody of my time knows exactly who Gil Scott Heron was because, I mean, his rapping voice, you know, on the radio back in the day, I mean, his philosophizing, I mean, this was a heavy brother. Known for his oral word performance, Scott Heron walked onto the international stage simultaneously, as did many of the other Black Arts Movement poets, including Amiria Baraka, Hakeem Matabudi, Sana Sanchez, and Nikki Giovanni. He shared their conviction that art must be functional, and therefore, as artists and communal leaders, he must embrace his role as a significant political voice, inevitably committed to the liberation of Black people. Scott Heron's voice resonated as well with that of Malcolm X, the militant Nation of Islam member who inspired a generation to address the needs and conditions of the urban Black masses. The electricity, edgy, angry, sounds he created with his fusion of soul, jazz, blues, and poetry, often in collaboration with musicians like Brian Jackson, make him a forerunner to the later generation of rap artists, particularly such social conscious rappers as Tupac Shakur, Jay-Z, Dr. Dre. Gil Scott-Heron released his newest album in February of 2010. Now, this is an old article, but Gil Scott-Heron, you know, was it's a lot of the poets are what led up to the hip-hop and rap era type of talking on the songs, you know, type talking about the conditions of our people on their songs. And, you know, Gil Scott-Heron, they were much more political than talking about the actual conditions, but the rappers seem to talk more about the conditions that our people were living under. But that's for another time, you know, but that's Brother Gil Scott-Heron.
All right. Go out and research, right, the brother. Listen to some of his stuff. Go back and check out Leroy Jones, right, Gil Scott-Heron. And we're coming up on this next one is The Last Poets. Tell us about The Last Poets, brother.
Now, The Last Poets are another one, you know, very political, very rhythmatic. And David Nelson, Glenn Kane, and Oye Wole, it's hard to pronounce his name, christened their spoken word collective The Last Poets in May 19th of 1968 on what would have been Malcolm X's 43rd birthday. They have been invited to recite their poems at a celebration in Malcolm X's honor. The three men were a part of a flourishing Harlem artist community, and their poetry epitomized ideals of the Black Arts Movement. The multi-disseminatory cultural front that was Black Power's fraternal twin. Just as Carl Rogers and Amir Baraka made poems from the political realities and experiences of Black folk, The Last Poets performed verses about the spiritual and cultural liberation of Black people with backing from Congo, jamborees, drummers, jazz musicians, and funk ensembles. The Last Poets, who acknowledged Baraka as a mentor, were among Black artists' most fascinating offspring, forerunners of contemporary rappers. Now, once again, they're talking about Amir Baraka, because Baraka was very similar to the way that Malcolm was like the fuse for the revolutionary and nationalist movements across the country. Amir Baraka was that same fuse when it came to the poets and the people that use the spoken word.
All right, you heard it right here. It's NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George, part 11 of what slavery did to us. And we're talking about our Black scholars. And now we're just getting warmed up. It's time for the heavy hitters. Brother, tell us about George G.M. James, one of the most impactful Black scholars of the 20th century.
Now, George G.M. James, he wrote a book called Stolen Legacy. And after he wrote that book, it wasn't long after that where he was killed on the college campus. He was run over, you know, by a vehicle. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about what James did. James was the author of the widely circulated Stolen Legacy. The Greeks were not the authors of Greek philosophy, but the people of North Africa, commonly called the Egyptians, also known as Stolen Legacy. Greek philosophy and stolen Egyptian philosophy, first published in 1954. That's why I said some of the books, they were already in circulation, but a lot of people didn't start buying them until the 70s. The 70s, a lot of these Afrocentric books and Afrocentric material was like flying off the shelves. In this book, James claimed that, among the other things, the ancient Greeks were not the original authors of Greek philosophy, which he argues was mainly based on ideas and concepts that were brought without acknowledgement or indeed stolen from the ancient Egyptians. He argued that Alexander the Great invaded Egypt and captured the royal library at Alexandria and plundered it. That Aristotle's ideas, the writings of ideas, came from those stolen books, and that he established his school without the library. The book draws on the writings of Freemasons to support his claim that Greco-Roman mystery religion originates from Egyptian mystery systems. Now, what James was talking about was that the same thing that I was alluding to back when I was talking about the Moors, that it always seems like once we get conquered, that they want to steal our books or they want to burn them or act like they're burning them, but actually they're getting our information. And then just like the example I gave you of in the 1600s, the scientific revolution took place. But in the 1400s was, you know, at the end of the 1400s was when the Moorish Empire got conquered and was ushered out of Europe. But they said that they burnt all our books, but they didn't burn them. What they did was they kept them, and then it took them 200 years to actually figure out what was written there, and then they republished it in their names. And it's the same thing that George D.M. James was saying that the Greeks did in ancient Egypt.
There it is, George G.M. James, Stolen Legacy. Your legacy, history, and culture has been stolen. It's your job to reclaim it. Educate yourself, people. Educate yourselves. All right, moving on. Joel J.A., a.k.a. Rogers, the greatest finder of facts in modern times. Give it to us, brother.
Joel A. Rogers was the greatest finder of facts in modern times. I don't even know if there was someone in ancient times that found as many facts as he did. Now, the accomplishments of our ancestors in the past is one thing, but Joel A. Rogers was able to find facts, you know, black facts, historical facts all over the planet. And he started publishing those things in his books. Now, the interesting thing about Joel is this. Self-trained historian, novelist, and journalist, Joel Augustus Rogers spent most of his life debunking pseudoscientific and racist depictions of black of people of African ancestry while popularizing the history of persons of black people around the world. Now, it's just like I said, he was a self-trained, you know, historian. No one, you know, he didn't go to college and get a degree and all of that to become a historian. He took it upon himself to start doing research, and he found himself, you know, researching around the world, and before you know it, he turned it into a profession. And Joel A. Rogers, I mean, did some phenomenal things. Now, these are some of the things that he did. Now, Joel Rogers held a variety of jobs, including a Pullman porter, which is on the train, and he was a teacher, but eventually he found his niche as a journalist and historian. In this capacity, he began to focus on combating what he saw as a white racist propaganda history in both books and popular films and other media of the period that omitted persons of African ancestry as contributors to world history. Towards the end, Rogers in 1917 published his seminal work, From Superman to Man. Superman to Man is an excellent reading. It's a lot of great facts in Superman to Man, even though it's listed as a fictional book. It's only fictional because the characters were fictional that were on the train. But the information is all factual. In this work, Rogers had his protagonist, a racist Southern senator, realizing finally that he was only a man. That's what Superman to Man symbolizes. Creator of Hollywood Film Studio that would produce films that highlighted Africa's gifts to the world. Subsequent Rogers books also dealt with this theme, including 100 Amazing Facts About the Negro, written in 1934, Sex and Race, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3, The World's Great Men of Color, and Africa's Gifts to America in 1961. And that's Brother Joe Ray Rogers.
Told you, pick up some of these books. Teach them to your kids. Even if you just do one page and one line at a time, get that man work and research some of your attention. Let's move on, brother. But first, we're listening to NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George's Part 11 of What Slavery Did to Us. And we're talking about our black scholarship right now. And guess who's next? Neely Fuller. Talk to us, brother.
Well, Neely Fuller Jr., he wrote a book. And he wrote a book called The United Independent Compensatory Code, a textbook workbook of victims of racism, white supremacy. In other words, he wrote a book to tell you what white supremacy was and how to deal with it. Fuller defines white supremacy as a system that dominates all non-white people in the known universe in nine areas of people activity: economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. The code also states that there are logically speaking only three major classifications of people: white, non-white, and white supremacists. The code is one of the sources of inspiration for the ISIS papers written by Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. Now, within Neely Fuller's book, Dr. Neely Fuller, he wrote 10 basic things that we need to stop doing as African-American people or black people. He said we need to stop snitching, we need to stop name-calling, we need to stop cursing, we need to stop gossiping, we need to stop being discourteous, we need to stop stealing, we need to stop robbing, stop fighting, stop killing, and most of all, we need to stop squabbling among ourselves and asking racist white supremacists to settle your problems. Now, Neely Fuller has a definition. He has a quote, and to me, it's probably his most famous quote, and you need to pay close attention when I say this. He said, "If you do not understand white supremacy racism, what it is and how it works, everything else that you do understand will only confuse you." Now, I'm going to repeat that. If you do not understand white supremacy racism, what it is and how it works, everything else you do understand will only confuse you. Now, he said another thing that was very interesting also. He said, not all white people are white supremacist racists, but you do have to be white in order to be a racist white supremacist. White people make to participate in a system that is in place when they are born, or to participate in replacing the system of racism, white supremacy, with a system of justice. Justice means guaranteeing that no person is mistreated, and also guaranteeing that the person that needs help the most gets the most help. That's Brother Neely Fuller Jr.
Neely Fuller Jr. Hey, Brother George, I want to go back over that list before the show ends. We're going to go back over those 10 things and that statement, and we're going to test the listeners on whether they know this list. You need to put this list in your mind and your heart and teach it to your kids. All right, before we move on, you're listening to NAA Community Conversations with Brother George. It's part 11 of what slavery did to us. And so we're chronicling our history, and we're giving you some knowledge and information. And right now we're going to slide on over to our good doctor, Dr. Francis Kress Welsing, the first to psychoanalyze white people.
Now, if you noticed, Neely Fuller Jr. Was Dr. Francis Kress Welsing's mentor. And so what she did was she took his philosophies, which he's still alive, and he still, you know, is on YouTube and still, you know, preaching and teaching the same things he was teaching back then. But Francis Kress Welsing was his, she was his student, and he was her mentor. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Francis Kress Welsing. And in order to really make it clear what she did and what she was, I'm going to have to say quite a bit. In 1970, her essay, The Kress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism, White Supremacy, was published while she was an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Howard University College of Medicine. That's where she received her doctoral degree, was at Howard University. This striking theory of the origins of racism is rooted in the efforts that vary degrees of melanin. The color-producing pigment in skin can have on racial perception and development. The quality of whiteness is a genetic inadequacy or a relative deficiency or disease based upon the inability to produce skin pigments of melanin, which are responsible for all skin color. She explained in the essay, adding, the majority of the world's people are not as afflicted, suggesting that the state of color is the norm for human beings, and the absence is abnormal. In 1991, she authored the ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors, a central and core argument for the African origins of civilization through the highlighting of the achievements of African Egyptian pioneers in the areas of architecture, science, philosophy, and humanism. These origins are often recolored and restated through Eurocentric fabrications, including the fact that some scholars have even dismissed the papers as not having made a direct link between racism and oppression, or even resistance to oppression. Not surprisingly, Welsing's views about global white supremacy and racism in contemporary society have provoked controversy and stimulated debate in and outside of the black community. In 1974, Dr. Welsing debated Dr. William Shockley, the author of A Theory of Black Genetic Inferiority, on national public television. Her theory challenged former definitions of racism put forth by social and behavioral scientists. Despite the controversy surrounding her, Welsing was praised in the Los Angeles Times for being the first scientist to psychoanalyze white racism in the history of Western psychiatry, rather than focusing on the victims of racism. In other words, she didn't, you know, come at people and like, oh, we so, you know, y'all always treating us bad and this and that and other. She didn't say that. She said, there's something wrong with y'all. You know, and so by her doing that, and also, you need to go on YouTube and see that debate, because she destroyed Dr. William Shockley in that debate. There was no, it wasn't really a debate. It was just, he was just sitting in his chair because he couldn't make any points. That wasn't even his specialty in the first place. But that's our sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing.
Woo, 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 woo. The Cress Theory and ISIS Papers. Our greats have laid it down, and now you must pick it up. Brother George, let's slide on over to the great Dr. Chancellor Williams, the blind man seeth.
Now, I use that phrase, the blind man seeth, because at the end of Chancellor Williams' life, he did go blind. And a lot of them go blind because they do an extreme amount of reading. They're always reading, and they're reading like in darker places that put a strain on your eyes. And he, like Dr. Clark, who eventually went blind, you know, he was, they're not, they're legally blind, you know. And, you know, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Chancellor Williams. Now, Chancellor Williams wrote the book, the well-known, most, you know, it's like a source book of black history called The Destruction of Black Civilization. And he talked about, you know, the things that we had accomplished as a group of people, the rises and falls of black, you know, empires and black achievement and, you know, social, cultural life and all of that in Destruction of Black Civilization. Beginning in 1975, Iggy Ogburn had the honor of traveling and working with the great author historian Dr. Chancellor Williams. Oogie is a photographer, and as Dr. Williams' assistant and friend, photographed him and his travels. Since Chancellor was blind, Iggy became his eyes, and Chancellor became a mentor who shared his wisdom and historical perspective. He documented this remarkable experience with photographs and audio tapes that provide an intimate glimpse of Dr. Williams' life during this period. Because of his blessing to have a relationship with the mighty doctor, he feels obligated to pass on to others Chancellor's messages and stories. The liberation of the mind was one of the main messages. To understand the African way and life contrary to the European, the ideologies and value systems of the oppressors unconsciously became those of the oppressed. Re-education of blacks, pay close attention to this, re-education of blacks will be required for the two mandatory changes in attitude, one towards each other in terms of mutual respect, and the other a change in attitude about efficiency, expertise in business management, and financial responsibility and management. In other words, he was saying the same distrustful stuff that has happened to us because of Willie Lynch. We'll have to be re-educated to gain a certain sense of pride about oneself, where I know that I can trust my brother in those type situations. And that book, Destruction of Black Civilization, is a great read, and you should definitely look into getting a copy of it. Chancellor Williams.
It's the NAAEA Community Conversations. We're giving it to you right here. Destruction of Black Civilization. We're talking about now the reconstruction of Black civilization through peace, politics, economics, athletics, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, culture, and education. We have to be able to reclaim our community, the reclamation project of ourselves with respect and the change in our attitude and financial management. You can do it all here at the NAAEA. All right, Brother George, we're going to slide on over to Dr. John G. Jackson, the great cultural historian.
Well, John G. Jackson was another one. I mean, these guys are like that I'm speaking about right now. I mean, these are heavy hitters. These are the men responsible for bringing back our history to us after the things that we suffered during the enslavement period. And that's why when the original title was What Slavery Did to Us, well, we came out of slavery and now we're getting to a point where we're restoring ourselves. But still, the reflections of what took place with us in slavery is still present. And that's why we need to do these things and continue. John Glover Jackson, one of our greatest cultural historians. Jackson was, he was an outstanding writer, and he moved from Aiken, South Carolina to Harlem, New York, where he finished his formative years in high school and then eventually went to college. Now, one of the things that Jackson also did while he was in New York was he was invited to write articles for the Honorable Marcus Garvey's newspaper, The Negro World. Now, remember that I talked about Marcus Garvey back in the 1930s and the Harlem Renaissance around that period. I talked about the Honorable Marcus Garvey. Okay, also among Jackson's teachers and associates during his formative phase of his life were Herbert Henry Harris, whom Jackson referred to as the Black Socrates, author Alfonso Scumberg, who was the founder of the Scumberg Library in New York. Author Scumberg, that's a serious brother, and he did a lot of serious work back during the time period of the Harlem Renaissance, when they were young men all coming to New York at the same time. And here's another name that y'all heard, Joel Augustus Rogers, one of the greatest historians and journalists of the 20th century, exactly what I said early on when I was talking about Joel A. Rogers, Dr. Willis Nathan Huggins, a brilliant historian and ardent Pan-Africanist. Beginning in the 1970s, John Glover Jackson, we call him John G. Jackson, produced several major books. These works include Man, God, and Civilization in 1972, Introduction to African Civilization, which is a classic of his, in 1974, Introduction to African Civilization, Christianity Before Christ in 1985, and Ages of Gold and Silver in 1990. Professor Jackson was one of the most remarkable scholars of our time, taught and lectured at colleges and universities throughout the United States, and resided during his last years in Southside Chicago, Illinois. John G. Jackson joined the Ancestors in October of 1993. Now, John G. Jackson, when I say that he was a cultural, that means that he was going to be talking about a lot of cultural things, which means that's why he wrote about Man, God, and Civilization. That's cultural. You see, Introduction to African Civilization, that's cultural. So he was very astute in cultural things when he said Christianity before Christ. What was Christianity before Christ came on the scene? John G. Jackson talks about those things. And so if you want to be well-read, you got to read John G. Jackson.
There it is, another one of our greats. And if you notice, each of these historical legends are all doctors, right? They're not just clowns writing to talk about what they think. They've done the research, they've done the work just for us. All we have to do is go back and restore and resurrect our minds to the intelligency that God has given us in these greats. Brother George, let's go to my favorite, and I call him the king, Dr. John Henry Clark, the pioneer who made Africana studies prominent in academia.
John Henry Clark is, you know, one of the most prominent historians, and you know, he's the pride. He's one of the prides of our people, you know, to put us back on the world stage, like he says, you know, like we're on a stage and it's time to perform. John Henry Clark, the pioneer who made Africana studies prominent in academia. In other words, he fought to get Africana studies to be a legitimate study subject in the colleges and universities. And that's why you have Africana studies departments right now, because of John Henry Clark. Dr. John Henry Clark was a Pan-Africanist writer, historian, professor, and a pioneer in the creation of Africana studies and professional institutions in academia starting in the late 1960s. Now, his legacy. John Henry Clark's greatest period of influence resides in the 1960s. Where he was a prominent intellectual during the Black Power movement, advocating studies on the African American experience and the place of the Africans in the world. He challenged the views of academic historians and helped shift the way African history was studied and taught, to redressing what he saw as a systematic and racist suppression and distortion of African history by traditional scholars, and accused his detractors of having Eurocentric views. His writing included 6 scholarly books, many scholarly articles. He also edited anthologies of writing by the African Americans, as well as collections of his own short stories. In addition, he published general interest articles. Now, John G. Jackson, you know, when you look at the challenges that he had to go through many debates with a lot of white scholars that were trying to challenge that, you know, what he was talking about, the same way as Francis Crest Wilson, that like, no, blacks didn't do that, and this, that, and the other. And I mean, when we get to the next segment, you're going to really meet some giants, you know, that they argued that point there, but that's in the next segment, you know. But John Henry Clark, I mean, he wrote some phenomenal books, and he was a great scholar. He was, you know, he was a man amongst men. John Henry Clark, the king.
There it is. I mean, it's all here. All we have to do now is do the work of acknowledging the work that they put their lives into. Many of them committed their life. It's their life work of doing that, so we can make ourselves as knowledgeable as possible. But now, for the next king and heavy hitter, Dr. Yusuf Ben Yakadin, we call him Dr. Ben, our great multi-genius.
Now, Dr. Ben was an amazing character, and if you ever hear him lecture, he's also very funny also. He can have you laughing while he's, you know, lecturing. But he was born in Gondar, Ethiopia. Dr. Yusuf Alfredo Antonio Ben Yohanan, or Dr. Ben, December of 1918, and he passed on in March of 2015. As he is affectionately known, he was devoted to Dr. Ben, as he is affectionately known, has devoted the better part of his life to the illumination of the indigenous origins of African civilization. By profession, he is a trained lawyer, engineer, historian, and Egyptologist. He likes to call himself a Kementologist. Now, that's four serious trades. That's why I said the multi-genius. Ben Yohanan went to Egypt for the first time in 1939, and he moved to Harlem, New York in 1945. Dr. Ben knew Malcolm X personally and was, once again, there's that connection with Malcolm. You know, Malcolm knew a lot of people, and he influenced a lot of people, and a lot of people influenced him, and was a student and colleague of George D.M. James. So he knew Dr. James also. He was exceptionally close to the late Dr. John Henry Clark. So, I mean, these was like heavy hitters that just hung around each other. That was their crew back then. Since 1957, he has coordinated regular study tours and pilgrimages to the Nile Valley, directly exposing university's African Studies Department. Dr. Ben has also been a professor at large at Azzan University of Cairo. Dr. Ben continued his weird, tremendously influenced on African studies into the 1990s. He was indeed one of the most unrelenting 20th century advocates of African origins of the Nile Valley, and he wrote books like Mother of Western Civilization, Africa, Mother of Western Civilization, Black Man of the Nile and His Family, and African called the Great African called Ramses, Dr. Ben.
It's all there. All you have to do is go back and find him. We're going for the last one, and not least, Brother Dick Gregory. Give it to us, brother.
Right. Dick Gregory was a pioneering comedian and civil rights activist who took on race and layered nuance humor during a turbulent 1960s. In other words, Dick Gregory was a comedian, and when he told his jokes were political. He would focus on the conditions of the people during that time, and he would try to, you know, he would even deal with some of the suffering of poor whites, you know, because Dick Gregory was a fair-minded man. But he sacrificed a lot. You know, he was out there with the Freedom Riders, and, you know, he just, Dick Gregory wrote a lot of books. He got into health science. He was just a phenomenal character. And I wish that I could just take a whole, you know, episode and do it on Dick Gregory. But he was a legendary brother. Love him. The 10 stops. Stop snitching. Stop name calling, stop cursing, stop gossiping, stop being discourteous, stop stealing, stop robbing, stop fighting, stop killing, and most of all, stop getting into squabbles among yourselves and asking white racist supremacists to settle your problems.
There it is. It's the NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George. Thank you, Brother George, again. And we'll see you next time right here on the NAAEA.
I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know.